and welcome to the Auburn Medical Group Podcast, Episode 6, for March 2008. I'm your host, Dr. Mark Fong. This month, I'll be interviewing Dr. Daniel Tsai, an Auburn cardiologist who has been with us before, and we're going to be discussing screening tests for coronary heart disease. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Tsai.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
Nice to be back. The reason we're laughing is because we're doing our podcast back-to-back, and so to us, it's just one after the other. To you, it's months apart. Okay, screening for coronary heart disease. The reason this comes up is because I'll often have a patient come in and ask what we can do to check their risk for heart disease and therefore get appropriate treatment for it. I guess where I would like to start would be with the simplest screening test that we would do in the general population. And when people are in their 30s and 40s, I generally recommend that they get their blood pressure checked every 2 years.
I think that's very appropriate and it's easy to do.
Okay. And then the next thing would be checking cholesterol, starting about age 35 for men, 45 for women, getting their cholesterol checked every 5 years.
I think that's very appropriate. Also depends on the history, of course. Why do you want to check it earlier?
Okay, yeah, let's go into that more about the history.
I think if there's a strong family history of atherosclerotic disease, by that I mean for men 55 or under, for women 65 or under, I think it would be appropriate for first degree relative to have their cholesterol panel check or lipid panel check earlier age.
First degree relative of someone who's had a heart attack?
Yes.
Okay. And then diabetes factors into this because that's a huge risk factor for heart disease. So there should be some kind of screening for that also along the way.
I agree.
Do you have specific recommendations for that? What way that would be done?
I would say depends of the patient's history and risk factors when to get a blood glucose level. It really has to depend on the person.
You recommend fasting or just a random check of the glucose?
I think fasting would be more predictable.
It's a lot easier to use.
Yes, absolutely.
What we do in our practice is people with the risk factors will get a fasting glucose. But we don't do it on everyone. We do it on people that have either risk factors or some kind of symptoms pointing us to think, hey, maybe we should check this, described by the patient. And then if we find it elevated, we follow up with the hemoglobin A1C to make a determination on if we need to treat them for elevated blood sugar or not. What about EKGs? Is there a place for screening EKGs?
I think the EKG should be used with discretion. I think sometimes it's overused. Certainly if a young person wants to exercise competitively, they should get a screening EKG. Interestingly, this country, being as wealthy as we are, we do not screen young men that are actively participating in sports, like in Italy, where they have a national screening program where all young kids participating in active sports get an EKG.
Hmm.
And that's to identify the risk of having unrecognized cardiomyopathy, which can lead to sudden cardiac death.
I had not heard that, and that's in Italy.
That's in Italy.
Okay. What kind of statistics, or do you know statistics as far as the sudden cardiac death in athletes?
The recent number that I have read was actually, it was just a month ago, where there was, correct me if I hope I remember this correctly, there was over 20,000. These are competitive athletes that had a screening EKG, and out of those, there were about 80. They were identified with some abnormal EKG findings. Out of that 80, 5 turned out to have, on further study, to have life-threatening cardiomyopathy. Of the 5, 1 died of sudden cardiac death and was not able to resuscitate it. 1 had a cardiac arrest, fortunately was able to be resuscitated.
So that's 2 cases out of 20,000 athletes. That's, is that 0.1 or 0.01%?
It's not a big percentage, but if you are the young man that have a life-threatening event, that's tragic.
Absolutely. And we're talking about a test that costs $30, $40 to run?
It depends on who the payer is. But the bottom line is it's easy to do, mm-hmm. and most offices have the capability of doing it.
Now that's something new to me. Thinking about doing that, I guess I'd have to look into our insurance is going to cover for this, or people are going to have to pay out of pocket. But that's something new to me, so I'll look into that. The next test I'd like to know about is the treadmill, the exercise stress test.
Treadmill is a nice screening test for appropriate patient with some risk factor. I think it's very appropriate to schedule them from a treadmill. I think most people now are doing, if there is some concern, to do a stress echo because it increases the sensitivity.
Echo being the ultrasound test that shows pictures of the heart while it's moving.
Exactly. Okay. And the way it augments a regular treadmill is you do an ultrasound of the heart prior to study. It also helps identify if the patient you're going to put on the treadmill has potential defect that could put them at risk when you put them on a treadmill.
And so this would be reserved for patients that have, say, high blood pressure and diabetes, or you're starting to collect some risk factors.
Correct. How do you stratify who should have a stress echo? It depends on the person's risk, such as diabetes, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, and particularly if there's some symptoms that you're concerned about. A regular treadmill is actually good for most circumstances.
Regular treadmill. Okay. And then some of the fancier tests, the nuclear test, percentine,
Sestamibi,
yes. Tell us a little bit about, are those different tests or are those all different variants of the same thing?
The Sestamibi is a nuclear study, and it can either be a chemical test where the person is given a medication in lieu of putting them on the treadmill, particularly for elderly patient with arthritic problems, patient who has difficult walking, a patient who have lung problems, that they can't really exercise on a treadmill. Then we use a chemical test with added nuclear study. And the reason for doing that, it has a little bit higher sensitivity of picking up multivessel disease, meaning not just one single artery disease, but more than, it's very, very good for multivessel disease. And for some patients that have some abnormal EKG, you can't really, which is not diagnostic, you would do a treadmill because the EKG interferes with the usual interpretation of whether it can be normal or abnormal. Then we put them through the nuclear study.
And this will give you information over the ultrasound or echocardiogram?
Right. There are certain situations where, for example, the ultrasound treadmill is equivocal. Some patients are just very difficult to get a good image, and their treadmill results are not clear-cut, or you still have suspicion that there may be a patient at risk. Then we go to a nuclear study, which is a non-invasive study.
Yes. And then what about these things that are kind of a step beyond that, that patients come to me asking for as a primary care doctor to refer for, specifically the CT calcium score or the so-called CT angiography with the, what is it now, 64 or 128 sensors on a CAT scan? What's your take on those?
I think they both have a role. I think a calcium score, if it's high, is a definite marker for coronary artery disease. But interestingly, I have seen patients who have very high calcium on angiogram, which is a picture of the arteries of the heart at a time. Angiogram means angio blood vessel, grams means picture of blood vessel. We see a totally calcified artery, but hardly any narrowing.
So calcium in the arterial wall.
In the arterial wall.
Not supplying necessarily blood representing a plaque inside the artery.
What we now know is people with high calcium can have a what we call remodeling of the artery, and the artery, in a sense, instead of getting smaller because of calcium buildup, they actually get a little bit bigger. It's kind of paradoxical, but sometimes that's what we see. Now, the CT angio is very exciting It is a so-called non-invasive test as opposed to an angiogram where we actually have to go into the heart with a catheter. The CT scan now actually is very good at defining the coronary artery, but it's still not the gold standard. The angiogram is still a gold standard. The concern with CT angio is the amount of exposure to radiation is much, much higher.
Much higher than,
an angiogram.
Angiogram or even a chest X-ray.
That I'm not sure.
This is...
Oh yes. This it's is much higher than a chest X-ray, of course.
Hitting your body from all sides.
Of course,
or at least from half
of course.
The sides.
Right.
But keeps you from having to have a catheter that actually goes through the heart itself. Two chambers of the heart.
To the chambers of the heart, to the opening of the arteries.
Yes.
It's
which
much
which
more
is
than.
Fraught with risk.
Yes, there definitely are some risks.
Do you have any statistics on that?
The risk of an angiogram includes heart attack, stroke.
And they do happen?
They do happen. The risk of that happening is less than 1%.
Okay.
But there's also a risk of the dye that's used. But again, a CT angiogram, there's also a dye load as well.
Oh, there is?
Yes.
Okay. And then there's a couple of just simple blood tests that people are treating with medications. The CRP or C-reactive protein and the homocysteine level, which are finding their way more and more into practice, kind of like checking cholesterol and prescribing statins. Where are those at, the CRP and the homocysteine?
I think the CRP is a very nice marker of coronary artery disease, especially when unstable plaques, because it's a marker of inflammation.
Is this something we should be getting on every patient who comes through the door?
You guess what I was thinking about. I had, when CRP came out, I test most of my cardiovascular patients with CRP. I found that most of the time, it really doesn't help. And I would use CRP now more on patients that I have some concern that they are at risk or they are unstable, but all other modalities does not indicate otherwise.
And what is the treatment available for an elevated CRP?
Actually, it's statins.
This... I see why it's not all that useful, because we're either already using them or not based on
right.
much more important risk factors, that being the LDL.
I think you are absolutely right. I think most physicians are very familiar with the recommendations and practice goals, and I think most doctors abide by those goals and the recommendations, and I think we're doing a very, very good job.
And then how about the homocysteine?
I'm not quite sure what to do with the homocysteine. Again, when homocysteine first came out and the thought that it may be a contributing factor to atherosclerotic disease.
Maybe.
Exactly.
I heard that.
And I put those, I would get a homocysteine level and I'll put patients on folic acid and vitamin 6 and B12. The data, to my understanding, is still in flux.
What harm is a trio of vitamins going to do?
You're right, except maybe the cost.
Maybe pennies per week if you get it generic?
You're right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we don't have to get a fancy one by a brand name, just maybe a general multivitamin. Would they typically have enough? Or are we shooting for more than just the 100% RDA for folic acid, B12, B6?
My sense, if you're going to treat homocysteine that's high, you probably should treat with recommended dosages, which would be high dose of folic acid.
High dose?
High dose.
Okay, so we're not talking what you get in your one a day or your Centrum.
No,
or your,
no.
Okay, it's a high dose compared
exactly.
to that. Okay. All right, so that covers all the tests I wanted to cover. Any last comments on the cardiac screening testing?
I think this has been very enjoyable. I think this has been very comprehensive.
Okay.
I don't have anything else to add.
No, I hope our patients find it helpful too. We welcome your feedback regarding our podcast, so feel free to email me at podcast@vonmd.com with your comments or suggestions for topics. And remember that you can subscribe to the podcast feed by going to our podcast webpage at auburnmedicalgroup.com. There you'll find our feed URL. You'll also find buttons for the Google or My Yahoo. If you use those as your RSS readers. Also, you can use iTunes. Just simply go to the iTunes store and search for Auburn Medical Group. That's it for this recording. I look forward to talking to you again next month. Until then, This is Dr. Mark Vaughn saying stay in good health.